ABC Listen.
It seems really barbaric that you've got this part of Australia that gives so much to the economy. The percentage of investment back is just so small. It makes you wonder, are we really part of Australia?
The true devastation of the flooding in outback Queensland is starting to hit home for residents, and some locals are angry their towns didn't have the warning systems to properly prepare for the deluge. And the volunteer backpackers choosing to spend their time in Australia helping sick and injured green sea turtles return to the wild.
Conservation is my passion. It's what I really want to do someday. But I've never really had a chance to do anything marine conservation related since where I come from in the States. I don't live near an ocean, don't have those opportunities. So when I came across it on Facebook, I kind of was like, this is something new.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. But first, let's head to Queensland, to Thargaminda, an outback town that became an island in the desert when floods hit the state's Channel Country recently. We've been hearing about these floods for a few weeks now, but it's only now that the waters have receded that we can begin to get a glimpse of just how devastating they've been for outback communities. The ABC travelled to the small town of 200 people over the weekend to chat to people and see how they're coping after the raging floods.
I came around, and at the same time as Steve goes, yep, this one's too big to plug, there's this massive hole in the levee wall, which is probably about the length of a car, 6 metres or so, but 8 foot of water, you know, just raging through this hole. And it was a really eerie sort of feeling. At that moment, I've come back to try to guide Steve and Dan back to an entrance or an exit now for them to get out safely. And the water was all through this yard. Almost immediately, it's a gut-wrenching feeling knowing that your friends are in this situation where you don't know how that's going to pan out.
Thargaminda local Jeff Pike speaking to our reporter Laura Lavelle. Now Laura joins me from the road now. Laura, it's heartbreaking to hear how powerless, I suppose, Jeff Pike felt in the face of this massive wall of water that came towards him. Thargaminda is a very small town of 200 people. How are people now that the danger is over?
Well, Sinead, I think that, you know, they're real Aussie battlers out here. You know, they're always very positive and thinking of someone else, not really themselves. But I think we've reached that point in the natural disaster now where people are just exhausted. 3 weeks ago, they were building up this levee frantically in the hopes it would save their town. 2 weeks ago, that levee gave way. And, you know, we just heard Jeff Pike there talking about the moment that he watched that levee burst its brakes. At banks, and he was just so concerned for his mates' lives, really, than himself, but his business was in the direct firing line. I think at this point in the disaster, a week since the floodwaters have gone down, it's really starting to hit people. They're going back into their homes. They're seeing that red mud through their homes. They're realizing how much damage has been done, and they're realizing it's, you know, not a quick fix. This is going to take years to recover from.
What does the landscape look like now? Like when you were walking around, what's it like?
Well, I'm currently sitting just outside the Bulu River, which is the main river outside Thargaminda. It's, you know, covering the main access point into town. And to paint a picture, there's just red dirt everywhere here in the outback. And it's pushed this red kind of silt dirt all through town. And that's covered the streets because that's what that levee was made up of as well. So when that levee burst, it spread this red dirt all through town. There's flood debris and fences everywhere. Even though we've had the SES, the Queensland Fire Department, volunteers in helping to hose out homes and clean up debris, the streets are just, you know, littered with the belongings of people's entire lives. And I think that's the most heartbreaking thing to see.
Laura, is it hard to believe that much water came through when you're looking at it kind of muddy and messy now?
It's so hard to believe. In some places where I stand, you have a moment where you're kind of like, the water would have been up to my neck now. You're in some people's homes and you're thinking, I would have been swimming here. And to borrow something from what Jeff Pike said, he described the landscape of Thargaminda in those days, you know, when the water went down, like a war zone. He said, you're driving through town, you know what's happened, you can see the debris in the fences, you're talking to people, you know a flood went through, but he said it's nearly like a mock-up. You just can't quite comprehend in your mind that this much water came through.
So looking at that, what is the cost of all that damage for people?
Yeah, it's so hard to put a number on it at this stage. Just from what we've been speaking to people on the ground, it really varies. Some people's had a little bit of damage to their homes. Other people's homes have been inundated with a meter of water through their homes. We did speak with Jeff Pike, and he estimates that his business has probably suffered nearly $1 million worth of damage. You know, that includes your product losses as well. Another hotel owner in town has a similar estimate here. And the main problem really is that the lack of insurance. People here aren't insured.
So they're not insured for that. I believe you spoke to one lady who was insured. Tell me about her.
There is a small population or small number of people who are insured in town. And she did say to me, you know, that really helps to ease the burden of this flood disaster, having insurance, because she said if she didn't have it for her business and her home, she probably just would have packed up shop and left, which is something so heartbreaking for people in the town here. But those who don't have insurance is a very different story. I think they're confronting a very different scenario as they enter back into their homes now, thinking to themselves, where do I start? What do I do? Can I even rebuild or recover from this at all?
Well, let's hear from Donna, who is the lady who was insured, and then we'll speak about those that weren't insured after.
I've got my sister, who is not insured. Water went, didn't go a long way through her house, but my sister doesn't have much at all. And so, but she's lost all her furniture, you know, but she's out trying to save what she can, because that's what you do when you don't have anything. You know, you try and save your white goods, you know. You can't just toss everything out if you've got nothing, if you don't have the money to replace it.
That's Donna Humphreys, whose house was insured, but she's talking about there. And obviously feeling for people that don't have insurance, like her sister. So what was the reason for people not having insurance? Did they tell you about why they didn't take it out?
They certainly did. And it's quite simple. It's just so expensive. We spoke with a woman here, and she said that she's had flood insurance her whole life. Her premiums were about $3,000 a year. But a couple of years ago, she got a renewal notice, and there was a new hydrology report done, so the flood maps changed. And after that happened, she got a renewal notice that totaled over $30,000 annually. She said she thought it was a mistake originally, you know, that they were trying to charge her annual premium monthly, called them up, queried it, and they said, no, this new report's come out, it's changed. This is how much you're going to have to pay if you still want flood insurance. The same thing with businesses in town here as well, just these exorbitant prices for flood insurance. They say they feel like they're being penalised for living in the bush.
They are eye-watering charges. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. When's the last time, you said there's been new flood maps done, Laura, but when's the last time they've seen floods at this scale?
Never seen floods at this scale before. This is a new record. The flood level hit 7.55 metres. Some people say it hit 7.65, but the reliable figure is 7.55. Prior to this, in 1974, we also saw an enormous flood hit Thargaminda, but the flood level there was about 6.43 metres, I believe. So really nothing seen on this scale before. Thargaminda isn't a place that has never seen flooding. When I'm looking out to the Boolu River now, they actually have a flood truck that ferries goods and people over the river when it is flooded. But it never really comes up this far into town, and certainly no one thought it was going to reach the level it did. When they built their homes, when they built this homemade kind of levee, they built it well above the 74 flood level, thinking they'd be okay, never for a moment thinking it'd go a metre over that level.
Absolutely. How are people going, trying to get back into their homes now that the water has receded?
A lot of people yet have been able to get back into their homes, have been able to survey the damage. I think this small saving grace, there's this incredible group of volunteers in town, you know, the SES Fireys. They're going in, and it's this mud army as they hit the ground. They're hosing out everything in homes. They're giving people a hand. But as I kind of said, I think in this point in the disaster, people are exhausted. The entire town was evacuated up to the airport. They were living out of their cars. And I think what is unique about this situation in Thargaminda, you know, when you have a flood hit Brisbane or North Queensland, it's a suburb or two that are affected. You have a kind of a clump of neighbours who are affected. But in this town, it's your entire town that's affected. It's your family, it's your mates, it's your business, it's your livelihood that's been washed away. And that's really what makes this whole situation so unique and so gut-wrenching.
We heard from Thargaminda businessman Jeff Pike earlier, Laura, but he also told you he was angry that there weren't enough functioning flood gauges along the Boolu River to help predict water rises. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
And we're Australian. We donate more money than what this would cost to implement. It seems really barbaric that you've got this part of Australia that gives so much to the economy and it supports the economy of Australia in a huge percentage, but the percentage of investment back is just so small. It makes you wonder, are we really part of Australia?
Thargaminda local Jeff Pike, and he's speaking to our reporter Laura Lavell. Now, Laura, what sort of government support is available to people in the region who've experienced these floods?
Yeah, lots of government support available at the moment, which is so incredible. There's small grants like the Emergency Hardship Assistance Grant, $180 per person, $900 for families for five or more, for things like food and medication. But really the main grant that people are relying on at the moment, especially those without insurance, is this grant for up to $80,000 for structural repairs, things like re-stumping their home, fixing the plasterboard, making it, livable so they can actually get back in there. There's also a grant for over $5,000 for couples or families to replace things like linen and white goods, which anyone who's ever been through a flood before will know that your fridge goes, your washing machine, your dryer, all your white goods, they're unusable. So things like that are really helpful.
Laura Lavell, thanks very much for talking to Australia-wide from Thargaminda.
Thanks, Sinead.
It's no secret that communities all around the country are battling a housing crisis. With costs sky high and rentals hard to come by, advocates say homelessness is on the rise. And in regional Australia, many people are turning to long-term campgrounds as a place to stay when they don't have any other home to go to. Eden Heinlein has this story from Western Victoria.
For almost a year, John Green and his friend Ruth Hall called the Greenhill Lake Campground home.
That's our setup. We even had little roads for in winter because it was all
muddy. Oh, wow, look at that.
And we had a gazebo.
Located on the outskirts of the Western Victorian town of Ararat, the friends lived there in their tents after their retirement travel plans were halted due to health concerns.
For 12 months, we're just in and out of hospital all the time.
While we were in a caravan.
We lived in a caravan that made life difficult. And then medically they've taken my licence away to drive. So that put an end to travelling.
For Ruth Hall, the area has become a place of comfort.
I mean, I love being here. It was just magical.
John Green lived on the streets of Adelaide for 10 years after a mental breakdown halted his journalism career.
I had an awful distrust of people and anxiety issues, and I was able to work around all those issues.
After retiring in 2022, John Green and Ruth Hall struggled to find permanent accommodation.
It doesn't matter who you are, whether you can afford the rent, it just doesn't matter. I mean, for every property, there's 40 people looking for them, and total pot luck, and we didn't have the luck, did we?
So they turned to the campground, a place they'd visited before. After almost 10 months of living at Greenhill Lake, the pair found a home in Ballarat to rent through a homelessness support program, Street to Home. It's become a common story for Adam Liversage from homelessness charity Uniting Ballarat, who says there's been a 200% increase in people living in free campgrounds around the town.
We have seen an escalation, or a big increase in the amount of people who are rough sleeping. Not just people, but also families with young children sleeping rough right across our whole entire region. We have seen an influx over the last, 12 to 18 months.
He believes there are more rough sleepers in the region they can't get to.
We are projecting to reach out to 270 rough sleepers by the end of the financial year, but they're just the ones that are actually getting to. It is such a vast area, and we know that there's more out there, but we just don't have the resources to get to them.
While Greenhill Lake has become a home for John Green and Ruth Hall, not everyone is happy about it. The campground's development board chairperson, Gwenda Mary Allgood, says it's becoming a challenge to manage the influx.
Some people have been there for years. They've got their solar panels out where other people can't park.
We're continually asking people to tie up their dogs. You know, they're breaking all the rules.
Gwenda Mary Allgood says to camp at Greenhill Lake, a permit is needed and campers can only stay for 28 days.
This rule's been broken all the time, and the Greenhill Lake Development Board, because they look after so much of the lake, are pretty disappointed that council hasn't done something about it for us.
In a statement, an Ararat City Council spokesperson says it's acknowledged concerns regarding the presence of long-term campers and is engaging with relevant agencies.
Eden Heinonen reporting from Ballarat in Victoria.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Cleaning tanks and scrubbing animal enclosures might not sound like the ideal holiday activity, but for a group of international visitors, volunteering to help sick and injured green sea turtles return to the wild is the perfect way to spend their time in Australia. As Jasmine Hines discovered, there's a lengthy waitlist of visitors wanting to help out on Coin Island.
I'm so excited. Spike, you're not supposed to have favourites probably, but he's my favorite. And when I first came here, he wasn't at his worst, but he wasn't at his best.
Thousands of kilometres from her home in the US, Meredith Fraker is about to help release her first rehabilitated green sea turtle.
Oh my gosh. He's kind of like the pool bully. He's got spunk. He's got personality. That's why I love him. He's very food motivated. but he's just... He's so curious, too. You can just see it in his face when he comes up to you. He's just got these big eyes. But even just in the month and a half that I've been around him, he's gotten so much stronger and healthier. And it's just really exciting, and it really puts into perspective why I'm here.
The 22-year-old is among a small group of volunteers working at the Coin Island Turtle Rehabilitation Centre off the coast of Gladstone in central Queensland.
Yeah, so this just kind of fell into my path through Facebook, which I found it. And conservation is my passion. It's what I really want to do someday. But I've never really had a chance to do anything marine conservation related, since where I come from in the States, I don't live near an ocean, don't have those opportunities. So when I came across it on Facebook, I kind of was like, this is something new.
The volunteers feed the turtles, clean tanks, make observations, and even gently scrub their shells.
I just recently opened the intake for 2026, and that's pretty much booked. I think we've only got 2 spots in July free, and then the next available spot to volunteer with us is October 2026. So yeah, pretty much all positions are taken for the next year and a half. But yeah, we've had people from South America, North America, we get lots of people from Europe, especially from the UK. But yeah, we've had Dutch people, German people, Italians, French people.
General Manager Kim von Outhausden says it's the only purpose-built facility for turtles in the region. She says turtles on average stay for 72 days and each cost the centre about $10,000, but some, like Spike, need extended care.
He stayed in care with us for about 135 days. He came in because he was floating. He was found by a fisherman that was out in his boat. He was fishing up at Kerman Creek, and he took the turtle to the mainland, and then we got the turtle down to us with the turtle taxi. He's had a long journey, so on average the turtle stays 72 days, but Spike was really up and down. He was very anemic, had some infection going on, and took him a while to respond to his treatment. But yeah, after 135 days he was ready to go. He grew 1.2 centimeters in length, and he doubled his weight. He was super skinny when he came in, very emaciated, and he was nice and plump, almost obese.
Kim says the work can be heartbreaking.
So 35% of our patients come in due to recreational boating and fishing. About 50% of those turtles make it. The other ones, like, their injuries are just too severe. We've got a few boat strikes in at the moment. A big adult male that has ingested fishing line. And the prognosis looks pretty poor. And it's really sad, because that's just because somebody has discarded their fishing gear. This innocent animal is impacted by that as a result of it. It's really sad.
But she says successful releases like spikes make it all worthwhile.
Yeah, he swam off strong. It's always good to see like the difference from when they come in and then being able to go full circle and then release the turtle back into the wild and then see him swim away so strongly. And it was cute because he just swam away and then just like did a little wiggle on the beach.
That's Coyne Island Turtle Rehabilitation Centre General Manager Kim Von Outhousden, and she was speaking there to Jasmine Hines.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
While wind turbines in Australia grow taller, the legal distance between these structures and nearby homes has remained exactly the same. Now, this has sparked a passionate debate within many rural communities around the country. Queensland farmers Neville and Gladys Franz live next to Australia's tallest wind turbines, and they're advocating for revised setback distances to minimise disruption to their way of life. This report by Brandon Long.
When Neville and Gladys Franz walk outside of their peaceful rural Queensland home, they look up at Australia's tallest wind turbines. The structures, 247 metres base to tip, are part of the 83-turbine Wombo Wind Farm near Diamondi, 280 kilometres northwest of Brisbane. They're significantly higher than the nation's first turbines, built in 1987, which stood 30 metres.
They're all around our boundary and all around our home. When you look out of your home or out of your patio or front porch, they're the first thing that you see.
Seven machines have already been installed near the Franz's fence line, and with another five to be erected, they will be on all four sides of their property. It's not the retirement they envisioned, having left their farm near Caboolture 21 years ago for a more peaceful lifestyle. They're worried about the visual and noise impacts.
We come to this area with the idea of settling down and retiring and have a lifestyle that suited us, which look down the paddock and see your cattle and see a nice outlook. But when you see these things on all the way around you, it's not so good.
During the developer's consultation phase, the couple declined to host the turbines on their property. However, their neighbours agreed to have them installed, and their locations are perfectly legal, erected just outside of the state's minimum setback distance of 1.5 kilometres from a dwelling. As wind turbines become taller, for instance, proposals near Billawilla in Queensland and the Blue Mountains in New South Wales have flagged 300 metre tall structures, there is increasing debate about whether setbacks should be bumped up to reduce their potential impact. Wombo Wind Farm said it was required to meet stringent noise requirements set out in development approval conditions, and once the wind farm commenced, acoustic experts would measure and report on the noise levels. The Franz family, which lives at Ground Zero, are calling on the government to implement a 3 kilometre setback for all future turbines. David Greenup, a grazier who neighbours the fully operational Cooper's Gap Wind Farm to the east near Kooranga North, believes a 2 to 3 kilometre setback would be more appropriate.
Our closest house to the Cooper's Gap Wind Farm is 1.5 km to the closest tower, and there's about 6 or 7 of them dotted around the top of a valley which heads towards the house, so that house gets fairly impacted.
The renewables industry argues longer setbacks are not necessary because larger turbines are more efficient and cost-effective, and technology has helped minimise noise. Chris O'Keefe, spokesperson at National Renewable Energy Lobby Group, Clean Energy Council, says current setback distances are adequate, provide certainty for developers, and longer setbacks would simply not work.
We don't think it would work at all. So far, pretty happy with where things are sitting at the moment. And, you know, I know Victoria's 1 kilometre, Queensland's 1.5 kilometre setbacks. New South Wales has got a bit of a sliding scale. We're comfortable with that. Those that's something the industry has been working with, and an envelope it's been working within for quite a while now. Investment is being dished out as a result of those rules, and any changes to those we would have concerns with.
In Queensland, the Department of State Development, Infrastructure and Planning determines those distances. A department spokesperson said it would continue to consult with local government, communities and industry as the next phase of reforms are implemented to ensure local communities and councils are given the rights to ensure their voices and concerns are addressed. The Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner, which independently oversees renewables and reports to the Commonwealth, says taller turbines may require longer setbacks. For tip heights greater than 200 metres, the Commissioner says a longer setback distance may be more appropriate to accommodate increased visual amenity impacts.
Thanks to Brandon Long for that story. Across Australia, regional towns are home to all kinds of diverse cultural groups from all over the world. And those groups are a huge part of the history and the future of country towns. In WA, an unnamed lane in a small West Australian town has become the home of a state-first commemoration of the Sikh people. Chloe Henville was there for the celebration and she brought this story to us.
On a sunny day in Dongra, a coastal community 360 kilometres north of Perth, a group of people are gathered in a laneway staring at a street sign. As a rectangle of yellow gold cloth comes down, the words Sikh Lane are revealed and the group erupts with clapping and cheering. For Sikh history advocate and event co-coordinator Tarun Preet Singh, the laneway opening solidifies his community's connection to the town.
So we came all the way from Perth and requested the society, historical society, and the Shire of Erwin that we want to make it a memorable day. In other words, we can say that we have come here to make history today in Dongra, that our roots have been solidified and nurtured for so many years.
The Erwin District Historical Society organised the lane's opening. Bruce Baskerville is the group's chair, and he says it's the first time in WA's history the word Sikh has been used in an official place name. He says the group lobbied for the tribute for over 2 years as a way to recognise the contribution of Sikh residents in the 20th century.
So although all the authorities have now approved it and there's a street sign being erected and it's on official maps, it's the people in Dongra who really wanted this and the people in the Sikh community.
Sikhs originated as an ethnic religious group in India's Punjab and arrived in Australia in the mid-1800s, bringing a faith steeped in equality and service. Dr. Baskerville says Dongra was a safe and welcoming community for Sikh migrants.
Really, the history of the Sikhs in Dongra is about trading and about commerce and business. The first Sikh men who came here in 1901 were hawkers. They operated a little hawking, which meant they went around house to house selling goods. By the time of the 1911 census, Sikh people formed 4% of the population in Dongra. And that's quite a significant number. And as far as we can work out, that's the biggest Sikh population in Western Australia at that time, you know, in one little town.
But the Sikh community's growth stalled after Federation as the White Australia policy restricted migration.
They could no longer bring their relatives here from India. And so over time, the men got older and older and eventually they died. That community seemed to fade away out of consciousness. And their shops here were bought by other people. They become other different sorts of stores and so on.
Dr. Baskerville hopes the newly named lane will keep Dongra's Sikh history alive and inspire other regional communities to explore their own roots.
If you look back in your own history in your community, you can find things that are really significant, that are really of cultural and social importance, that are much bigger than just our little town. And so I think that's what the naming of the lane also reflects.
For Mr. Singh, working with the local historians has been a rewarding journey.
We built a sort of relationship with the historical society, the Erwin District Historical Society, a few years back. And then with the growth of the relationship, the Dongra community was happy that the Sikhs are taking interest in Dongra history. And we were excited that we have found some foothold, some roots in Dongra.
And when the sign was revealed, Mr. Singh was overcome with emotion.
Sikhs should be included as part and parcel of Dongra. And for us, we have no words. We cannot express our gratitude to the Dongra community and the society in words, like just feeling an emotional that we have found our place in Dongra now.
Great excitement, Tarun Prit Singh, ending that story from Chloe Henville. And that winds up Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Great to have your company. Cheerio.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.